thank you very much.
Well, has the Congress begun yet?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Now, I'm going to make some people sorry when they didn't come. So this time, why, we will have to take up something far more significant than we just took up. Because, what we just took up, it's minor. Just solve the basic problem of the ages. And find out what we're mostly agreed on, you know. And that's really not very much to take up an hour. And we'll get down to it. Really get down to it now. I will take up the remaining factor. I really did talk about communication, if seen from the viewpoint of radiation, in the first hour, and then I took up control. There's been a lot of argument about control, you know. Terrific amount of argument. First time control was sprung on a bunch of Scientologists, they said, meow, no. And I said, but so-and-so-and-so-and-so. They said, Ron, we've lived with you through black and white. We have suffered with you through creative processing. We've even gone so far as to walk around endlessly all over London. But now, Ron, you've gone too far. It's too much. And I said, well, I've never asked you to really do anything for my sake before. Just for me. I said, half of you run the other half on control. This way. Give me your hand. Thank you. Give me your hand. Thank you. Give me your hand. Thank you. Of course, these boys have lived through op pro by dupe, so they could do such a thing. They said, what happens if the fellow says, well, I've just got a cognition. You say, give me your hand. Thank you. So you don't acknowledge? No, we've gotten up to a point where we can even violate dummy auditing in the comm formula. Oh, you don't even acknowledge anything the fellow says while you're doing this? I said, you'd better not, because you'll be talking to nothing but circuits. Give me your hand. Thank you. Give me your hand. Thank you. Wow. All right. For your sake, Ron, we'll do this. Give me your hand. Thank you. Give me your hand. Thank you. Give me your hand. Thank you. What's those? Give me your hand. Thank you. They all of a sudden found themselves making faster gain. They grabbed a couple of cases that had no results and, give me your hand, thank you, give me your hand, thank you. And they said, hooray! It's good for the auditing room, but no place else. Then they went out. They've been trying to buy vegetables and things from this fellow for a long time, and they would say, have you got some turnips, you know, or have you got some of this? And he would say, well, I'm all out today. And how about some coffee? Well, I'm all out today. How about some razor blades? I'm all out today, you know. And they went down, and he had everything they asked for, and he offered them no argument and chit-chat, and how'd they manage that? Do you know I even think you could handle a rationing board now? You could probably go down and get petrol stamps by the bucketful. They would say, have some more petrol stamps. Have some more. Have some more, you know. Have some more. So we come into having this. And that is the third factor of the trio. ARC, Affinity, Reality, and Communication, becomes Control, Communication, and Havings on an upper look. We are now looking at Axiom 3, and all of these are Axiom 3. And so they run out. Axiom 10, and all lower axioms. And by actual test, you will be able to determine and establish this with considerable ease. This is an easy one for you to determine. Everything we're talking about in this Congress is something that you can do rather easily. For instance, tomorrow I will be talking about a chemical compound. You can run the experiment on this chemical compound and find that it violates the pharmacopoeia. The authority on the reaction of chemicals on the human body is not correct. So don't be surprised if a few other things are found to be incorrect all of a sudden, such as control is bad. That's incorrect. The best thing that this society knows about control is attempted sometimes. Good positive knowledge. Well, that's an entirely different thing than control. We have something entirely new in man. We have a way of control which does control without man's introducing a great many lies, punishments, or anything else. And we find then that when control is done from this level, that life becomes possible, bearable, and understandable. And it isn't below that point. It becomes a confusion and a mess. All right. Now we look over at this point called havingness, and we find out that an understanding of this oversets many traditions. Everybody knows that the only way that you could ever get anybody to do anything is to make everything scarce. That's the best way to do that. You just make everything scarce. There must be an upper class and a lower class. And the lower the lower class can be put, the more work you get out of them. Everybody knew that here a half a century ago. Everybody knew that. If you really wanted to get anything done in the society, you had to have hewers of wood and drawers of water, is what they used to call them. And these people could only be on a slave level. Since the Roman Empire, we have known conclusively that slaves were necessary in the society. And we have known how to make a slave. You just don't let him have a single thing that you can possibly keep away from him. You don't let him have good quarters or clothes or food. And you beat him up and chew him out. You let him have no status with regard to the state. He mustn't be permitted to vote. None of these things are allowable to a slave. And if we deny him enough havingness, then we will have to have that very necessary item called the hewer of wood and the drawer of water, without which the society cannot do. That's more or less the way it's been. We've had to grab somebody and then deny him havingness so we could have him. Now let's look at this from another quarter. If we have a slave, do we have anything? Nope. And thus went Greece, and thus went Rome, and thus went the industrial empire-type civilization of England and America, because it's pretty nearly gone now. America, you know, used to be twice as colonial as England. Imperialistic policies abroad. Very interesting thing that these things have all sort of disappeared. Only they disappeared on the wrong side of the ledger, you might say. It's a liability that they happened. That's different than kind of losing something. It's too bad it ever existed and now we have lost it. Look, did anybody have anything when they had a slave country? Well, obviously, they couldn't have had very much if they found it impossible to retain. So their havingness of it must have been very nebulous. And so it was. You always had to have troops going up and down and surrounding the barracks and policing the town, policing the capital, one way or the other, in order to keep these slaves in check. Because the slaves, the more they were denied havingness, insisted on having something, which was unreasonable of them and was not expected and was not posted as part of the game they were supposed to be playing. They were supposed to sit there and knit or tap or go out there and hew wood and draw water, and that's all they were supposed to do. And you know what these fellows did? They kept insisting that they had something. Now, their revolt is the biggest engram on the track of modern civilization. And it came from the Middle East to Greece to Rome to our present society, where it's more or less faded out. Now, what's this idea that you have to have a slave, have somebody in order to own other things? You've got to have somebody hewing wood and drawing water and so forth. Well, the boys are to this moment still trying to solve that problem. Only now they want to solve it in an entirely different way. Popular Electronics in the United States has just published an article culled from the greatest universities of the world, not just American. And this article tells exactly the experiments which have been run of putting electronic electrodes in people's heads and giving them orders, stimuli, so that to get responses to get them to work. It goes on and on and on about how you do this, and thereafter you will have a worker. You cut holes in people's skulls and put electrodes in and stimulate certain things, and he has an electronic switchboard radio thing in his pocket, and you turn a dial over here, and this human robot goes around and does something. He hews wood and draws water. And this, these fellows think, is feasible, merely because it is electronically possible. And just because slavery was possible back through the ages, they thought it was feasible. Just because you could make a slave, they thought you should have a slave. In order to get work done, you had to have slaves. If there's anything crossed up on our modern civilization track, it is that one. That work is done by slaves. And that we have to deny people things in order to keep them working. We have to make wages scarce. We have to make things hard to buy. We have to make ownership very difficult. Or else we get no super control of the masses. That is the very way we get revolting masses. We deny them enough, and pretty soon they turn the tables the other way. First time they did this was in the 1780s, to any great degree in modern civilization, over in France. And it was enough that you had a pair of pants, if you please, to be indelicate, to go to the guillotine. If you just owned a decent pair of pants or a pair of shoes or something like that, somebody would point at you and say, "Aristocrat!" And the tumbles would roll, and the widow would go funk, and they would basket one skull down to the nearest lime pit. Why? Headings. Upset, concerning. This gives us an explanation of everything that has happened on the track. Why does it give us an explanation? Why? How can we apply this so broadly? We say there are other factors. There was control and communication. Yeah, but we say there were other factors than having this control and communication which made the civilized idiosyncrasies which we have witnessed down through the passage of history. There were various philosophies of politics, all these philosophies of politics which were considerably thought out and German, and there was communism, and there was Voltairism, and all these other factors were responsible for the social evils which we finally behold. Oh, no, they weren't. They were the figure people went into when they'd lost things. That's communism. Communism is just an effort by a bunch of commissars to have at the expense of a bunch of slaves who are kept in a have-not. Oh, but do you say that's not the definition of it? I don't care what the definition of it was. This is the fact of it. This is what it looks like when you see it up close at work in the countries where it is working. And that's all that counts. That's all it counts. All it really counts about Scientology is, or anything else, or any other chain of thought. All it counts about Scientology is whether or not in those areas where it is being applied, And with those people where it is being applied, are they living a better life, a healthier, a happier life than they lived without it? If the answer is yes, then it's a good thing. And if the answer is no, then it's not. You see, the final application, now you can always make something better, you can improve it, you can communicate it better, you can shape it up so that it's more workable, more usable, but in the final analysis, it is the area of operation of a thing, not the thing which counts, as far as philosophy is concerned. If communism worked, Russia would be the greatest manufacturing nation on earth. If colonial imperialism worked, the United States today would rule the entirety of North and South America. So we're looking at old dead philosophies. They haven't worked. Because any nation that was made a part of another nation by force, duress, and slavery proved a liability to it so great that the owning nation was sooner or later happy to get rid of it. There was a war which almost destroyed the United States, called in the South the War of the Rebellion, the war between the states, called in the North the Civil War. An interesting war, since it was the first time the United States had gone into this convulsion, and so it found it an intriguing phenomenon, a phenomenon it had never before experienced. England had been through this in a dozen ways, France, older nations. But it was new, strange, and peculiar to the United States, and therefore they're sort of stuck on the track about it. And this war was a bloody one. And the funny part of it is, the heartbreaking part of it is, that it was fought between the North, which thought the South shouldn't have slaves, and the South, which had found out the South couldn't possibly have slaves. And they were both in total agreement, but they fought a war without finding it out. Since 1835, most of the states of the South had been trying to agitate legislation through their legislatures to let them free a few slaves and to get off this slave economy. And their main worry was simply this, that each planter's capital was tied up in a great many pieces of humanity which were paid for by gold dollars. And therefore, they wanted a return on their investment. So merely to free them would have brought economic chaos in the South. So their argument was, somebody ought to pay us for these slaves. We already know that it is an unworkable social activity. And the North was probably fighting the South without even knowing too much of this. But certainly it would have paid the North to have paid the South for its slaves. And there would have been no civil war and everybody would have been happy. Except for this fact, man had been made into a slave. He had been a slave. The Negro in the South had been taken from his homeland and had been pressed down into slavery, had been denied any semblance of humanity in the current literature. It's quite amazing to find a debate as to whether or not a Negro has a soul. Ridiculous sort of thing. Should he have any right to go to church? He should have no right to go to church because of so-and-so. Here's a totally debased philosophy that was brought into the country in the early days of no labor, which everyone knew was to some degree wrong. Because it is not true that a Negro is a lower being. It is not true that a Negro is born to slavery. The only places where a Negro has any difficulty is where educational advantages and civilization advantages have been denied him. In other words, his havingness has been reduced to such a point that the struggle for life becomes so desperate that he can do no other thing than to eke out an existence with no higher attainment than maybe a bowl of rice or gruel. His havingness is so bad that he cannot pull himself up without help. Only where he has been depressed to a point where it is impossible for him to pull himself up without help. And so the Negro had been brought over from Africa, and he was brought into this area of the United States called the South. His slavery was continued, and a have-not was played on him. He couldn't own a thing. That is the first definition of a slave. He is a person who is owned and who does not own. The moment that slaves can own private property, they are no longer slaves, so most slave-owning societies deny the slave the right to own any private property of any character. All of his private property belongs to the master. This is one of the basic definitions of a slave. And here were these people, brought in, depressed into slavery, denied cultural advantages, and then, if you please, suddenly and ferociously freed without any real economic aid or support. And the do-gooders just cut them loose, and that was that. No great program of education was engaged in. Nobody tried hard to make this freedom real. The United States government used to talk about giving them 40 acres and a mule. So they'd give somebody 40 acres and a mule, but his trouble was trying to feed his wife and his kids. So what did he do? What did he have to do? He sold the 40 acres and the mule to the first Reconstruction white man that he ran into. He got nothing out of this but a few dollars with which to live for a few days. It was a program that was all awry from the very first. And to this moment, we still have this compulsion in the United States, although the slaves have been free for 90 years. Clinton, a little town, very short time ago, had National Guardsmen running around in jeeps with machine guns mounted on their cowls. Why? Because people objected to Negroes having an education. Negro schools were bad. White schools were already crowded. Without solving the white school crowding, they suddenly put all the Negro children into the white schools too. The Negro schools were very poor. Here was a have-not again. In other words, they continued to run have-not on these people, decade after decade after decade. They can't get over this idea of they mustn't have. Wage scales are in their disfavor and so forth. You understand this? We're getting some kind of an attitude here toward a certain group of people that they mustn't have any more than they have. But because we don't give them any more than they have, they stay then in a liability in the middle of the society. Here's a fascinating problem. We have started to run a have-not upon a group of people, and their problems and difficulties are still with us, although they have been, quote, free, unquote, for 90 years. Listen, Greece tried to free its slaves. Rome tried to free its slaves. And Great Britain at this moment is trying madly to get rid of slave states that it enslaved with the torch. It's trying to say, no, no, no. You go ahead and rule yourselves. Self-determinism. Get over there and rule yourself. We don't want anything more to do. It's just too much trouble to listen to just one more person who gets out there in the public square and who says something on the order of, natives of Tuna Shabasha, arise tomorrow and drive out the usurper. Just commotion, 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 commotion. And the moment one of these people has been freed without any further having this, without any further reorientation, without any further education, she has at once revolted against her conqueror. And so Great Britain has had continual trouble with every one of these countries that it has freed, and every time it frees one, it'll continue to have trouble. That's for sure. We tried to free Cyprus. Cyprus would smash it in the face. Of course, it's not a very serious thing. Few people like that, ill-armed, so forth, striking back at anyone. But it certainly is unsettling. You're trying now to be the great civilizer, and the people just refuse to consider themselves, cut loose. They keep saying, you did this and you did that, and we need this and we need that, and you give us economic aid, and we'll give you back the fact that we're free, and see what a dreadful mix-up this thing is. Why is it a dreadful mix-up? It's because somebody embarked upon the course of no have back on the track someplace with a certain group, and without a reorientation is then unable to free themselves of that slavery. Unless somebody can solve this problem, there is no such thing as freeing anyone anywhere. If we run a have-not continually, on and on and on, we run have-not, have-not, have-not on some group, And all of a sudden say, well, we're ashamed of ourselves now. We won't do this anymore. Look, you people, you're free. Go on. Here's a couple of guns so that you can police yourselves. And they say, thank you. Boo! And we say, why did they do that? We're being human. We're being nice. We're being kind, good. Every time you try to free some pre-clear circuits, you get the same kickback. You say, we're going to fix you up so you won't be sick anymore. We're going to audit you and so forth. Well, a pre-clear who isn't in too terrible condition, audited rather smoothly, of course, always says, boy, do I feel better. Isn't this nice? What do you know? A wall, you know? He plays the game, he comes along, he snaps out, he becomes more able, and he becomes an asset. A bigger asset to his environment. But listen, you're auditing the people who are walking up to your front door, and I'm willing to tell you right now that the rest of the society isn't going to walk up to your front door because they're not that smart. We even run a not have on people, professional auditors, the Hossie and the rest of it, of necessity. We say if you haven't some pounds, you don't get processed. Why are we doing that? Well, the reason we're doing that is because it's a medium of exchange and agreement. You say, we're in the middle of this society too, and we have to spend and earn, we have to live. We have to pay wages in the Hazi. You, we have to pay room rent. We have to eat. Oh, but is this really a have-not? Is this really a have-not? No, because we're barely within reason. We're within reason. You see? It is possible for somebody to work for a while and get that amount of money and pay for some processing. That is possible. That can happen. So that is not a violent have-not, is it? And it isn't, because it's in the field of feasibility. Then what do we mean by have-not? Well, let's add it up this way. Never have. There are certain things which you must not have, that you cannot have, and that you will never be given. Now, that's the aberrative one. Now, I'm afraid you field auditors and in the Hazi should never feel very sad about taking some money away from people. Quite the contrary. The fact that they can pay you for some auditing lets them contribute to the situation. And the funny part of it is, if you don't permit them to contribute, they feel that they themselves are have-nots, and you re-stimulate them onto a charity basis, and they refuse to get well. And an auditor who does not select pay for auditing has more trouble with these pre-clears than auditors who elicit pay for auditing. Because it's a possible have, don't you see? It's possible for this exchange to occur. Well, now, a never-have is something else. You must not have freedom. You cannot have equality with the aristocracy, they said in Greece. You cannot have full freedom, they said in the Roman Empire. A freedman has certain rights, and these are. And believe me, they didn't come up to a citizen. See, they were just running this on a sort of a total. We get along a little bit further, and we find in most states that have run this sort of thing that a man had to have a certain amount of property before he could vote for a member of the Senate or something. He had to have property before he could be enfranchised by the state. And that is one of the oldest forms of voting enfranchisement. He had to have the ability to own property. Well, a freedman could not own that much property by law. You didn't have any... No, he hadn't been given anything then, had he? He had never been given any self-determinism in the state. In other words, he was persisting in a state of slavery. And there you have the people who are out there who will never walk up to you. They will never come near you. Not because they haven't got, can't get the pounds. It's because mentally they're totally educated to a point where they can't even have help. They can't have you. They can't have your services. They can't have anything else connected with freedom. And their only answer is, well, if we can't have it, destroy it. So they argue against you, they argue against the state, they argue against officials and everything else. You see how they do this? They can't have it all. And the answer to that is destroy. A nation only goes to war with a nation which it cannot have. One of the interesting ways of freeing a country, just highly theoretical, one which possibly has been followed from time to time, is simply to free some country and say, at the same time you free them, you say you realize in freeing you that you will have to supply 5 representatives to do the work in the House of Commons. And also, you have to pay the same fare on the British railways and steamship lines as anybody else when you come to England. No more, no more of this, we'll bring you here by charity and fetch you and educate you a little bit. Whenever you come to England, your people have to pay just like the British. Okay? You just have to pay like anybody else. You let them have the whole country. You'd have to, because by moving out, they have a feeling, even though they're slaves, that they somehow own Great Britain. And now, if they're no longer closely associated with it and can't travel all over it and, you know, have British goods and that sort of thing rather easily, they feel disenfranchised. Havingness is the solution to slavery. Havingness is the solution to labor problems. Well, everybody knows havingness is the solution to labor problems. Everybody knows this. Industrialists all know this. You know how to go with this. You get a company union going, and you raise your pay and raise the income tax rate so that the pay is adjusted again. And you give them a committee meeting of some sort of, and let them have a say in something. That'll fix them up. Oh, will it? Look, they're dealing with people who, for centuries, have been disenfranchised from all kinds of havingness. They're dealing with people who not too long ago wore silver collars to tell who they belong to. And that's the tradition that labor goes back into. They're running into have-nots that are so positive that the moment that they say, have a little bit, somebody starts shooting. And you get the derangement in the social sphere whenever labor is given a break. The tradition of slavery is too strong. They know they can't have things. Now, it takes techniques powerful than any society on earth has had or has in order to solve the problem of the have-not, whether on a national or an international basis. You have to understand what havingness is. Havingness is what a fellow can have. And that's all it is. That sounds like one of these odd definitions, you know, that defines things by itself. You have to think it over for a while. But it's the clue to all havingness. Havingness is what a fellow can have. That's what havingness is. And it isn't what you think he ought to have. That's not havingness. You get the difference? It's a very vast difference. To so much of a difference between these two things that unless you work havingness on a preclear in a way to permit him to have what he can have, he doesn't have, and so he doesn't recover from anything. If you tell him, supposing you ran a preclear this way, you'd say, well, maybe this is, sourly, you might say, well, maybe this is one of these control processes. You know, pick up the table and dump it on his lap and say, you can have that. And pick up the couch and dump that on the table and say, you can have that. And pick up a chair and dump it on the couch and say, you can have that. And then wonder why he didn't get over it or get well or something. Now, it would require a necromancy, I'm afraid, that's beyond anyone's power to compute exactly. You could approximate it. No, you'd have to give him what he can have. And therefore, you have to let him look around the room and find something he can have. That's a very important part of it. His selectiveness is below the level of conscious thought. His ability to have is so slight that if you go to a nation like Ireland, where people had a can't-have run on them, not by this nation particularly, but by generations of Iberian rule and other rules that the Irish don't even now know about, they don't know much about their history. It's quite remarkable. We read so much about the Irish that know everything there is to know about Ireland. And I was over in Ireland for quite many months, and I kept digging and digging and digging around here and there, and I'd hold up bits and pieces, you know, and I'd say to an Irishman, did you know about this? No, it wasn't in his tradition of what he should know about Ireland. For instance, they all think they got their black hair because the Spanish Armada was driven ashore on Ireland by Drake. They tell you this. That's where that came from, you know. Big ships were pounded up there. And then there was some port out there in Galway and so on. And that's where that came from. Oh, no, they're Spanish people. I don't know how did they miss the short sail between Galway and Santander? Northern Spain sailed straight to Ireland across a sometimes foggy sea. And the way you would do this, you would sail out into the Atlantic so as to be blown up on the coast at Galway. And then somebody wonders how they got their black hair. Now, people lose these traditions when they lose hattingness, because nation after nation has come along and taken the poor Irishman and booted him around and said, can't have. Actually, one of the most, slightly heartbreaking little song is Gary Owen and the Gary Owen. And they have struck for freedom, and they now have freedom, because the fellow man named Gary Owen is dead. He's the tax collector. And every Irishman can now have a cup of tea. Freedom. A cup of tea. You look over this background, and the level of can't have that has been run on the country monitors its ability to recover. Right now, Ireland's having a terrible time economically. Why? Well, if you've ever been over to Ireland, trying to audit people off the streets of Ireland, you'd understand we have an office over there right this minute. And trying to audit these people is one of the most fantastic things you, a British auditor, or an American auditor, ever attempted. Look around here and find something you can have. That question just is not real to an Irishman. He will monkey with it, fool with it, dabble with it, and you'd certainly better ask him what he's doing with it after a while, regardless of what he's saying, because he hasn't a shadow of what you're talking about. I ran a girl one day for about 25 or 30 minutes just on the first question, trying to get it clear, and finally she looked around and found some things she could have, and then I asked her exactly how she was having them, and she said, well, that's very easy. I look around and I see that, and then I realized that if I had a lot of money, I could go out and buy one, and I could have that one that I bought. Now, an auditor finds this very significant. The number of vias by which this person could have what? Please, a scrap of paper on the floor that's been wadded up and thrown away. I've asked these people, can you... You see that dirty piece of cigarette stamp that's been torn off a pack and thrown down there? Now, could you yourself have that? And they say, no, it probably belongs to the person that tore it off. No. No, the return of Ireland to an economic stability, which they're not now enjoying, doesn't happen to depend on anybody subsidizing them or giving them anything. It depends on their own ability to have. And if that is not raised, then they will not recover. And what are we looking at? We're looking at peoples condemned by the past track of not have to a point where no amount of milk and beans and rice and Cadillac cars dumped on the back of their necks would ever do anything for them, except maybe resent all these obstacles that had been dropped around that they have to walk around to get any place. Now, I would never, never, never be critical while abroad of the American State Department or the American government, because I'm abroad, you see. Never, under any circumstances. So I'm giving you the next part of this speech in America, and it's being brought to you by tape. The American Economic Relief Program, as fostered by Foster, is not only a bungled mess at its inception, but is totally unworkable and never will be workable. To dump on the backs of the Arab peoples a bunch of Cadillac cars is the American idea of solving the Arab economic situation. Harry S. Truman had very, very good ideas on this. After he got processed enough, why, he started to snap and spark. The only president in history that ever went out of the White House in better shape than he went in. Thanks to Dianetics. Oh, you didn't know that. But he wouldn't run again. He got up there and gave a nice Dianetic speech to the Democratic Convention that says, go on, vote for Adlai. That was the end of the Democratic president chain in America. He knew when to get out. He got smart enough, he could even exteriorize from his job. All right. Now, what happened? What happened when this next fellow got in there? He was all right, maybe, for a while. He's a man of high principle, and so on. But he has an unfortunate, a very unfortunate weak spot. He will only listen to an authority. He detests hearing anything about anything from somebody who isn't an authority on that subject. So he surrounds himself by authorities who do his thinking for him while he goes play golf. It's grim. Because who's the authority on mental reactions in America? That's right. A philosophy that was thrown out of Germany 100 years ago as unworkable is now the mental philosophy that is used by the government in America, except in those departments which now use, smartly, Scientology. But the authority who were used on the Arab mind and that sort of thing will be some psychiatrist who just pulled out of an institution someplace, you know. They don't know anything about it. Yes, he listened to an authority. That's fine. But has he ever listened to really an authority on the Arabs? No, he listens to an authority who is an authority on authorities on the Arabs, who himself has not been so far away that he's been forgotten. And so, we get these totally unreal programs. Let's give $420 million worth of economic aid to the Arabs, and that'll all square everything up, and so forth. Harry Truman could have given them some agriculture and a few things like that, and he meant to. But now it's just, let's dump some Cadillac cars on the back of their heads. That'll make everybody happy, and then we can pick up the Suez. At last, of course, being broadcast from America, and it's not foreign to conception. This program can't win. Man has reached a dreadful impasse in this world. Very soon he will realize that you do not dare set anybody free. Only in this century has he been really experimenting thoughtfully with freedom. He experimented 2 centuries, getting on 2 centuries ago, over in France with freedom, and he had a convulsion which wiped out nearly all of his havingness across the top because he tried to turn over to the not-haves all the havingness of the country with the Republic. And France went up in smoke and has probably never again regained anything like its economic stability that it had before that time. The French Revolution was a chaos, it was a convulsion, and is used as a horrible example of what you must not do if you are ruling the world. You mustn't give people this broadly their freedom, because you get kicked in the teeth. And the world is liable to learn this terrible lesson. It's possible it's already learned it, is you don't dare set men free. A fellow by the name of Hershey that makes the milk chocolates is a good example of this. He tried to give his workmen in America the first parks and separate built homes and first dwellings that were at all fit to look at. Recreation grounds, playgrounds. He tried to give them all these things. He was a very advanced industrialist. He had a min of money. His factories were a model of workability. And about the time he'd set them all free from their economic restraints, we have the picture, the rather pathetic one, of Hershey himself standing on the top of one of his factories, which was surrounded by all these model homes in all directions, and mobs of screaming workers shouting for his blood and firing at him with small arms. I guess they educated him not to set anybody free, didn't they? Well, this all breaks down to that. What is this thing called havingness? It's what people can have. And if you load them up with what they can't, they will fire back. I imagine you'd get quite a revolution if you dumped an awful lot of coal in the city streets of a nation that doesn't use it. And so it is mentally to these people. When you set them free, what are you doing? You're going to give them something. Is that right? That they haven't had before. You can say, well, you're going to give them political principles. You're going to give them democratic rule. You're going to give them self-election. They don't know anything about this. But you're going to give them something. They're going to have something that they didn't have before. They're going to have their own government or so on. What's a South American's idea of government? Bang, 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 bang. See? Government is a chance to shoot the last president. Now, when you have to have something that's absolutely vital and that's been denied, after a while you don't even have to have it. So the process of denial works out to a process of no possession, to a process of impossible to possess, which goes down to, if it comes my way, I'll kill it, wreck it, destroy it. You see how this works? So if we try to give somebody a country that they haven't been permitted to have, their next action and reaction is to destroy it. And so they do. Filipinos are very good, very advanced people, very fine people. I had a lot of friends out there when I was a kid. But a wild thing happened the first time that the United States Navy ever gave them a destroyer to manage all by themselves. That was about the grimmest thing. They didn't even give them an officer or a motor mech to, or a machinist mate to go along with it, because the Filipinos didn't want one. And all the brass in the engine room was brightly polished. They could have that, brightly polished brass. You just never saw so many yards of beautiful polished brass as appeared in that destroyer. They scraped the paint off everything that was painted that could be made bright. But there were no tubes left in the boilers, no firing mechanisms left in the breeches of the guns, no bilge pump in working condition. Nothing aboard that thing that could run was left in a running condition. And the destroyer was beautiful as it sat at anchor in a shallow part of Manila Bay, so that its bottom, resting on the mud, could keep it afloat. But it wouldn't run. And yet some politician had always been saying, we want our own Navy. And somebody complied, but they don't have a Navy. Do you see what happened? They destroyed it covertly. Covert destruction. Now, it doesn't mean that Filipinos would always do this, but it certainly means the Filipino had been denied this type of machinery long enough so that when he finally did get it, he couldn't have it. But he could have some bright brass. He himself makes bright ornaments. Do you see this? So what is the world going to do in the face of atomic fission, in the face of new democratic principles, of new ideologies and all this sort of thing? What is it really going to do? Is it going to just convulse and flash back in the face of everybody who tries to do anything for it? Or is it going to somehow or other bungle through in spite of radiation, atmosphere? Or is it going to fall flat on its face and not go any further? Is it going to die with a whimper or a bang? Because a polluted atmosphere, polluted with radiation, could make the world die with a whimper. Without a bomb ever being dropped in anger, we could all be wiped out by enough radiation accumulating in the atmosphere. We just get sicker and sicker, and after a while we'd be so sick that nobody could do anything for anybody else, and that'd be the end of the civilization. Or bang, somebody drops a bunch of bombs, somebody else drops a bunch of bombs, and there's now so many bombs dropped that nobody can live either, whether we was hit by the target or not. This sort of thing lies in the future. It's enforced havingness. It's a havingness we cannot have. We obviously cannot have these things. Has atomic radiation ever been political? Oh, yes, I dare say, for the history of this universe, atomic radiation has been political in its connotation. It has been used as a control mechanism since the end of time, beginning of time. And as a person can't have control, atomic radiation is used as a control mechanism. Those people who can't have, tolerate, or give control are therefore susceptible to radiation. And because people have seen planets destroyed and things destroyed, they're thinking in terms of planets being destroyed right now. Their having this on the subject of the planet would have to be pretty good before they'd start worrying about losing it. They're not worried about losing it right now, but they could be worried to a point where they could only destroy it. Their having this on their fellow men would have to be rehabilitated because atomic energy makes an only one out of each of us. Brahmanism was probably the remnants of some old atomic attack in the old days or some disease. You know how only one that is. Every man cooks his own fire, uses his own utensils, cooks his own food. It's quite interesting. You could look forward to something like that in other societies if radiation kept up. But it runs a no-have on us all. And that's the point. It's saying you can't have this planet. It's saying this planet is going to get so polluted and contaminated that you, in the state that you're in, will not be able to tolerate and support your own beingness here. Therefore, you cannot have this planet or this civilization. And if people are driven too far down on that scale, they eventually respond and try to destroy that thing which they cannot have. And just the presence of atomic radiation for no other cause is inviting disaster and destruction on the part of the peoples of the world greater than ever before. But it'll also tend to make slaves out of every person on earth, because slaves are made with no have. And nations and governments thrusting this idea of the atom bomb down the throats of populations may be working merely reactively. They probably are not thinking about this at all. But what does it say? It says you can't have Earth anymore. You can't have Earth anymore, but you're here. That means you're a slave. What are we facing? A future where we get all our brains wired up and somebody presses a switchboard somewhere and we then shovel some wood and hew some water? Well, that's the direction this is going. It says, go out of communication with none another people because you're poison to each other somehow. It says, we are controlling you so badly and so absolutely and so never returnably that you must be depressed into a slavery status deeper and lower than any slave has ever been depressed on earth. And it's saying you can't have this planet, you can't have your homes, your family, you can't have anything else. And you'll never be able to have these things again. And whether you like it or not, you're at the make and break point of the human race. But there is one thing which reestablishes an individual's ability to have. There's one thing that can change his mind on this subject. Whether in groups, whether he's individually being addressed or not. Even a catatonic schizo today could be audited by Scientology with success. We no longer have to have a man's consent to audit him. We no longer have to worry about whether or not he said yes before we started the session, because we can get him up to a point where he'll eventually find out what we're doing, find the auditor, and say yes. We can only do this because we're not making slaves. We're freeing men the only way they can be freed. Improve their ability to have, improve their ability to do, and grant them once more the power to be. And if we can do these things, and if we do them, perhaps there's some hope for this race. But if we don't do them, there's nothing there, as far as I can see, but an end of track. I'm not backing up the hearse. I'm really not. But if a person knows something, the only unfriendly thing he can do, if he knows something somebody else should know, the only unfriendly thing he can do is not to speak. And so I am speaking to you today. Not to try to frighten you, because that is the main trouble with the bomb. It frightens people. I'm not asking you to worry about the atomic bomb or radiation in any way. I'm merely asking you to look it over on the problem of processing, of livingness, and decide whether or not you and we can do something about it in a practical way. We're not talking in favor of revolution. We're talking in favor of evolution. For the first time, when atomics hit a planet, maybe one can survive. And that would have broken a cycle of action that's evidently been going on for some time. Therefore, what we are talking about here in this Congress has an intense practicality. It's not, perhaps, to others a very important subject, but the subject is just whether or not we, us, will live through it. And I think the answers are rather in favor of our doing so. And I hope you think so, too. Thank you.